I had this wish deep in my heart to become a nun. There came a time when the calling was so strong. I wanted it so much, but every single knowledgeable person I went to said women can't do that. You can wear white, you can shave your head even, and you can cook and clean for months in the temple. You can never be a monk. I remember one period I cried at least an hour face down into the pillow every day because I would never be a monk.
So although I'm one of the more senior bhikkhunis in Theravada Buddhism these days, I began my entry into monastic life as a teenager. And even as a very young person, I think when I had the chance to read the Buddha's teaching or to see something with regards to Buddhism and Buddhist monastics in movies, books, in magazines. I remember seeing the saffron-robed Buddhist monks of Southeast Asia in magazines like National Geographic. Then I was interested in what is this Buddha and this enlightenment and the way of sages, what it is to be a sage or saint, and what that might be like as a Buddhist monastic. I was in university and working, but feeling very unfulfilled and doubtful in that, and very heavy at the thought of what the prospects were of life that were presented before me. I felt really very heavy in my heart and very concerned about the kind of strife and grief that I saw between people and in our world, environmental destruction and global conflicts, wars, these kinds of things. And I held this very heavily in my heart. And when I encountered the Buddha's teaching of the Four Noble Truths, a sense of faith arose in my heart that perhaps this really is true. Perhaps the Buddha has actually really truly seen the causes of suffering and realized their cessation, and that this might actually be possible in human life. And this is a kind of enormous revelation for me, because so many people are so doubtful about this. They said to me as a young person, you know, just get real, kid. You have to grow up and get with the program. I mean, just buckle down and go to work, go to school, you do what you have to do. And these are just the ordinary sufferings of life, and life is like that. You know, it's a dog-eat-dog world, this kind of thing. To see people who were trying to live differently and who were living differently was a really great opening for me. So as a teenager then, I became an Anagarika and first traveled to Europe, and then the great excursion for the first time to Asia, to India. To see many kinds of sages. Very many kinds of sages and aesthetics, and then to go to Northern Asia, where I had the opportunity, what's normally called East Asia, to connect with a bhikkhuni mentor, a bhikkhuni community, spend time in the mountain forest monastery of South Korea, and later when I completed my training with my bhikkhuni mentor, I had the chance then to go and go as my heart called me then to Southeast Asia, to Thailand, where then I was already a bhikkhuni, and the sight of a bhikkhuni at that time was very rare. And I saw the situation for the nuns who did not have, like their Korean bhikkhuni peers, did not have full training, ordination, and support within Thai society. And that touched on a deep chord of compassion in me, which then moved me to do what seemed like might be possible to be done, to bring forth a kind of underground stream of the women's monastic sangha, let that come back up into the world, in the tradition where that had lapsed. Yeah. And so that's been my life for much of this last decade and a half. These days, now the time has passed, and the number of bhikkhunis we have in Theravada has increased. We've been very glad now to have the bhikkhuni peers and to help, to be able to play some small role in enabling others who shared in the aspiration that I had myself, to also be able to enter into this life, live in a way that their hearts have also deeply called them to, and to do that as a sangha, as bhikkhuni sangha together, following the Buddha's teaching and Vinaya together, so that our sila, our Padimokkha sila, our samadhi, our meditation, and our wisdom become complete and replete.
Mythology or comparative linguistics, but like the deeper reason I was going was to like find my questions, because the scholars I really admired weren't people who just did it as a kind of hobby, but they did it like from their heart, like they answered the questions of their heart, and I just wasn't sure what my questions were yet. So I went to India, and when I was in India I stayed at an ashram, which I think a lot of Westerners do. It's kind of a stereotypical story. And so when I went and stayed at this ashram, I guess like this whole like world opened up for me, which hadn't been part of my context or part of my life up till then. So, you know, I just learnt yoga and meditation and chanting, but there was this whole way of like being in the world, connecting with the world, that I hadn't really understood up to that time. And then I was staying in India, and I had to go across every 6 months to Sri Lanka for a new visa. And so I'd stay at a meditation centre while I was there with Nilambe. And so while I was there, I started learning how to meditate, and I read books about meditation. And then I just had this feeling that that was like what I'd been kind of hunting for all this time. And so, so that's how I started. And so, of course, like lots of people who begin meditation, I thought, well, you know, I'll just take a year or two off from my career, and I'll just meditate, and then once I've realized, I'll go back. And of course you realise once you start practicing that there's a lot more to it than that, and so that's really why I became ordained, because just to dedicate myself to that.
I went to Harvard University in America, which was supposed to be, you know, a place where people were really intelligent. But one thing I noticed was that even though the people were intelligent at an intellectual level, they sure didn't seem very happy. I remember walking around campus and noticing that actually on most people's faces was this look of tension and stress. And I myself very much felt that tension and stress. So I asked myself, you know, what does it really mean to be intelligent? Like, what is the point of being intelligent intellectually, but you weren't happy? If one were really intelligent, I thought one would know how to be happy. That to me seemed to be the most important thing to know and understand. But what that experience was very important is that it clarified in me what I understood to be the point of this life. You know, what was the most important thing was to study and practice the Dhamma so that one could grow in it, to grow spiritually. And for me, that made it clear that that was the most important thing in life. At that point, however, I didn't have this idea that I would become a nun or anything like that, because you know, nobody talks about becoming a nun. People talk about becoming like investment banker or lawyer or doctor or engineer. Or, you know, those are the things people talk about. But no one talks about like, you know, where's the best place to become a nun. So this wasn't really something that was in the air. But I knew that eventually I would like to commit myself more to spiritual practice and to the spiritual life. I just didn't know exactly how. But also I had this feeling that it seemed kind of serious. I just wanted to like have fun in my youth, you know? I wanted to just have some fun and get it out of my system first. And so in my early 20s, I just, you know, did what most people, just average, normal people do. I got a job in New York City, and this was the most fun city in the world, and just had fun, just, you know, did things that other young people did. But it didn't take me long to get bored of it. It was like, okay, well, this is fun, but so what? Like, after a while, it gets repetitive. How many times can you go clubbing? And another important thing that happened around that time was that my mother became very ill with something that was diagnosed to be a terminal illness. And so the concept of mortality, which we kind of all think we know that everyone's going to die, I'm going to die, people are going to die, but until it actually happens to someone close to you, the truth of it doesn't really hit home. And what it did is that it made me reflect back that, hey, I don't know how long I have. This whole plan to like have fun first and then get serious about the Dhamma. I thought, well, you know, who knows how long you have? I think it's time to get serious about the Dhamma. I experienced a different kind of joy living in the monastery, and I saw for myself that it was a very peaceful and safe life. Safe in the sense that you were able to maintain your virtue without much difficulty, because the whole monastery is set out to help cultivate wholesome qualities in the heart. And so for me, that was really what I saw was the difference. In lay life, one can be trying to practice, but it's very difficult without having supporting conditions to help you try to you know, keep your precepts well and to do a little more to let go of the self or let go of the defilement. And I found it was much easier in the monastery. It's just set up for it. You've got the routine, you've got the precepts, you've got the Kalyanamita, the good spiritual friends, which includes fellow monastics and especially your teachers. And so for me, that all of that very much made it clear that monastic life would very much help me to grow spiritually and to study and practice with the Dhamma more wholeheartedly. And so I decided to go for it. But one thing that I remember from my time as a layperson staying at monasteries in Thailand, they always do morning and evening chanting together in most monasteries, and there's part of the morning chanting where the monks chant something that's a little bit different from what lay people chant. So there's this part that only the monks chant, and I remember there was a particular line where it was saying that, you know, the bhikkhus who are fully equipped with the full system of training, the complete system of training. And I remember every time I heard that, there, it would just be like this dagger in my heart, you know. Kind of, it made me really sad that that wasn't available for women. That women didn't have the full system of training to really grow on the path. And I wish that there would be a chance for me one day to be able to have that full system of training. And so I feel so blessed and so grateful that I have this opportunity now to be able to have all of the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha rules, training rules, to help me learn and grow in wholesome qualities. And so I think it's really such a wonderful feeling when I took part in my first two Patimokkha chantings. It's only been two that I've done. But it was just such a wonderful feeling to be able to feel like I have this full system of training now, and I can, you know, use it not as a way to say that I'm better than other people or that I'm so much more pure now that I have all these rules, but really just sort of have a more complete textbook, you know, to learn from.
I was raised in Australia, coming from a Catholic background. For many years I practiced as a Catholic until I became what I call a lazy Catholic. And it was during this time, I think, of being a non-practicing Catholic, insofar as I didn't go to church on a regular basis. I didn't take communion as Catholics do. But I think the moral standards that I was given as a Catholic person has always stayed with me. I wasn't aware, I don't think, that I was actually searching for something more than what I had. As far as I was concerned, I was happy in my work. I had good friends. I had a place to stay. But obviously deep down I was searching for something a little bit more deeply. From then on, I guess I was very aware that I started looking for places and countries to visit where I could experience more of what I'd come to know as the Buddha Dhamma. It took me to Taiwan, where I stayed for 11 months in a monastery over there, training. It took me to Thailand many times, to meditation centres, to temples, where each time I went to these countries, I was influenced in a different way. Until gradually I decided that this was the lifestyle that I wanted to live. I wanted to study Buddhism. I'd been attached to a centre in Sydney for much of this time, and I'd become very friendly with the monk who I first encountered at the Aquinas Academy, a Buddhist monk, an Australian Buddhist monk who had trained in Thailand, and who was a wonderful Dhamma teacher. And I had a lot of contact with him. He and I were very good friends. And I said to him one day, I'd like to study Buddhism. And he said to me, well, go to Asia. So that was what I anticipated doing. It was at that time that I was aware that there was a Buddhist women's conference being held in Nepal. And at the same time, in India, in Bodh Gaya, the Dalai Lama was giving a very good discourse on the Bodhisattva path. And so I decided that I would combine the two and see where that took me. And it just so happened that I went to the Dalai Lama's talk first, which was very, very deep, but very, very meaningful for someone searching. And I then attended the Satyadita conference in Nepal, where I met my head nun from Sri Lanka. And after speaking with her about my desire to become ordained, she suggested that I come and stay at her arama in Sri Lanka, in a little village called Aheliagoda. She said to me that it was very poor, she didn't have many facilities, but I was welcome to come and stay there. And she appeared to me to be a very kind and a very compassionate woman, so I decided to go and stay there. And that was where I have stayed and lived and ordained, both as a seminary for 4 years, and then as a bhikkhuni. I became ordained as a bhikkhuni in Sri Lanka, in Dambulla, in 2004. And so between Australia and Sri Lanka, I've travelled for the past
year. I came to Buddhism. Actually, Buddhism came to me. I originally from Austria. Then I came to Australia. I was married. Had a very comfortable life. And at a certain time, things were good, very good for me. But I could see even rich people are not happy. And as I walked through life with more and more open eyes, I could see there was no satisfaction anywhere to be found within myself and outside of myself, in the world itself. Whenever I had wishes, very often, if you are a little bit lucky, a little bit of good karma nowadays, one would say, things came my way. And yet, very soon after, you wanted something else. So slowly, in that sense, even not knowing the Buddha's teaching, in my own way, being observant of life and of my own reactions, I could see there's no ending to this endless wanting. So in a way you become then not only bored, but also somewhat disenchanted. And I still remember in the 90s at some point, I was staying at the health retreat outside of Sydney. And as I was walking over to the reception area, the thought arose in my mind, should I play tennis or should I play bridge? And neither of them was really of interest to me. And it seems at that time, my mind went into a deep, natural, calm state. In that depth of this calmness,
a question arose in my mind. And I still, because it was so powerful, I still remember it until now very clearly. The question was, do I want to continue with this easy, shallow way of life, or do I want to look for the truth? And without hesitation, I opted in a very strong aditan, in a very strong wish, in a very strong determination to find the truth. I came out of that state and continued the next few days. And yet, bit by bit, here and there, changes took place in my life. And once again, now I clearly understand cause and effect and how powerful the mind is, and the mind is the forerunner. So also I had good friends. And there was a very close friend in the block of apartments I lived in Sydney, who was actually a Buddhist. And one day she said to me, my teacher, Munindraji, from India, who was actually trained by Mahasiddhartha in Burma, said, my teacher is coming to visit me. I had the afternoon to myself, didn't know what to do, and suddenly remembered. I had an invitation to come down to see my friend and her teacher. So I walked down and knocked on the door, and there was my friend, and she introduced me to her teacher, who was an Anagarika Munindraji. And being Indian, he was also very inquisitive, he said, and what are you doing? And of course, perhaps he meant to say, how are you? But I just really truly understood, what are you doing? For a moment, it was a very personal question, I was a little bit shocked, taken aback. But then suddenly, perhaps because of his presence, I realized, I'm really doing nothing, meaning I'm doing nothing with my life. So I answered him, I'm doing nothing. But I had at the same time a much deeper understanding that truly, I'm not doing anything with my life, except having a good time, being of help, being of service to others. I wasn't a bad person. But still, is that all? So then during the afternoon, Munindraji said he's going to give a meditation retreat at Wat Buddha Dhamma. The abbot there was Prakantapalo. Many of you probably know Prakantapalo and also Ayakema at that time. And I knew I had to go. I had to go to that meditation retreat. So later on I told my neighbor, I'm going to the meditation retreat. So she said, you can't possibly go. You know nothing about Buddhism. She was very much an intellectual. She was from Holland. And she came to Buddhism in a different way. She eliminated, she went through all the major religions, studied them, and eliminated one by one. And he said, Buddhism I can accept to 80%. And for the other 20%, she went to Bodh Gaya to do a long meditation retreat. So this was her style of understanding. So I came from a totally different angle. I just said, I feel I have to go. So she was very concerned. So she rang up Ayakema and said, I have my neighbor coming. She knows nothing about Buddhism. Please look after
her. I was young, we were not very rich, yep, simple lifestyle, but the way my mom and dad cared for family and friends and neighbors, it really was something that really inspired me to be one who is of service to others. Yeah? My parents were really my very first teachers of being of service to others. Okay. Now, when I was young, I was actually educated in a convent school. Together with my elder sister, both of us were educated in the convent school. So, of course, at that time, you know, I was like going to church happily and learning the scriptures and all that, accepting that, you know, whatever happens to me or whoever is all the will of God. Yeah, not really questioning. It was until maybe about my teenage years that I started to see a lot of inequalities around me. Yep. And I started to question, this can't be the workings of God. God is God because He's fair. He cannot be unfair. So there must be some other reasons for why people are suffering. So during my teenage years, I actually started to ask questions like, why am I the daughter of this mother and this father? Why am I not the daughter of another pair of parents? I asked myself all these questions. So of course, I didn't stop here. I also asked myself questions like, you know, why is this family so rich and that family so poor? Why are these people so, well-supported? And why are others not? All these inequalities that was going on right in front of my eyes, I had a lot of questions. So at that time, I had no idea what Buddhism was all about, yeah? Until one day, I have an aunt who took to the Mahayana teachings in a Chinese temple. That was the first time I heard about the word Buddhism. And I was working as a volunteer in a Buddhist counseling center. And I remember telling myself one day that, you know, in order to help people, I can't just volunteer. I think the best way of helping people is to be free from samsara so that we can be totally free from suffering. And that was when that aspiration to really become a nun, to learn Dharma and walk the path of the Lord Buddha really took great strength in me. Yeah. And that was how it all started.
I was asked a question by one of the masters there. He says, so is Buddhism an inward journey? And at that time, I didn't realize what he was asking, what the inward journey was. And I started investigating, I started looking into it to find out what this journey was. And I started reading about Buddhism, did a lot of reading and to find out what. And then I found out it is an inward journey. I had to do it by myself. Reading books won't help me to practice Buddhism. So while studying the thing, while reading books and doing my job, I, at a certain point when I was very, very successful, I had two schools and I had my own house and I was, and my children were married and they were gone. So then I decided this is a good time for me to give up everything and start my looking into my
Actually, I'm born Buddhist, and actually I started my spiritual practice actually from when I started to meditate, because before that I'm just like a Vesak Buddhist. I go to sometimes, you know, go to all the celebrations and maybe sometimes Katina or, you know, sometimes once in a while I will go to offer dana to monks, you know, that sort of things. But I don't really click me that, you know, that I never thought that I want to become a nun one day. That's never occurred in my mind. But until when I started to meditate, and that is my turning point in my life, because of that experience, that the first time I experienced another type of happiness. You know, before that, I only, the one option, the only happiness I know is from, you know, getting nice clothes, having nice food, you know, and that kind of sensory pleasure, that kind of happiness comes from that kind of sensory pleasure. And until when I first experienced the taste of that inner peace and inner happiness that within myself, and that is nothing compared. It's just like, you know, when you have something very gross, that kind of like more gross happiness compared to this happiness is more refined. It's just like when you have refined food, it's different from, you know, wow, it's just completely different. And this is how it draw me into the spiritual life. Then I started to meditate more, because I love to meditate. Since then, I meditate a lot. Even though I'm working, I meditate at least 4 to 5 hours every day, daily. And I started to spend more time to do retreats. And then after that, I started to stay in monastery. And I just love it. I just enjoy the kind of lifestyle. And this is how, like, I don't have the idea of I want to become a nun, no. It's just very naturally I've been drawn into monastic lifestyle. I just love the lifestyle, and this is how I decided to become a nun. Because of that, it's because I enjoy the lifestyle. It's not because I want to become a nun, but I enjoy the kind of lifestyle. I love the
book about the Buddha, and it was basically the story of Siddhartha's, you know, miraculous birth and his going forth, leaving his wife and child behind. That actually didn't impress me at all. And being enlightened, I didn't really understand what that was. From reading some of my readings in Indian philosophy, I had a little bit of an understanding my understanding of enlightenment was that it was this sort of a melding with this cosmic sort of ocean-like consciousness or something like that. And so this guy who left his wife and kid to go and meld with some cosmic consciousness actually didn't do anything for me. I went for this walk in Ladakh. It was a 4-week trek through the mountains, and I was just totally amazed at these people who were so poor and lived a such harsh lives in freezing cold. I mean, they were cut off for 6 months of the year by the cold. They had hardly anything to eat. Well, they don't. It was very, very, very simple life, and they all seemed so happy, and they were so generous, and they'd share their last sort of handful of barley with you. And everywhere I went, I found people like that in this place, and I thought there must be something to this. And I figured, the common thread through all their lives was, of course, Buddhism. And I sort of, I promised myself that I would investigate Buddhism when I got back. And, which I did. It took me a few months. I actually rang a Tibetan Buddhist centre in Fremantle and kept getting no answers. So I left that for a while. And then a few months later, my yoga teacher told me about the Dholamara and Dharmaloka and how they had meditation classes, so I went to the meditation classes there. And as they say, the rest is history. From my first meditation class, I started meditating every day for at least, 15, 20 minutes. And within a year, I went to my first 9-day retreat. And I trained for it. I remember I used to train every morning for an hour. I thought I have to be able to sit longer. It was quite funny, really, looking back on it. But I also, just little by little, began to find out about nuns. Because I quickly realised that it was not quite as easy for the women as it was for the men. I mean, I'd visited Dharmasara in 2004 for the first time, and I think I saw Ajahn Vayama, and one of the things that she said to the group of, there was a big group of people there, because I think it was entry to the rains, how difficult it was for women living in the forest. And I looked around me at this gorgeous forest and I thought, how difficult is that? I think it would be a wonderful place to live, and I still do. It's just wonderful living here.
And I worked as an actuary for a few years. And when I was about 23, I failed my first exam. And I failed probably a second exam. And kind of realized this business of passing exams and sort of working crazily, trying to become a big shot in the financial industry, wasn't really going to solve anything. And I quit my job, and my fellow actuarial friends bought me a backpack because they knew what I was up to. And I went to India, And for 2 years I sort of did what I wanted to do, which was trying to, even though I was sort of brought up a Buddhist, to kind of explore the range of the spiritual world. And in India, that was definitely the place to be. Like, it's a supermarket of spirituality. If you want to, you know, try and get enlightened acting like a dog, you can do that. You can whirl around at the Rajneesh ashram, you can sing bhajans in Bengal, you know. I tried a lot of things. And in the meanwhile, Liam Butler, who is now Venerable Buddha Rakita, also who I met in Singapore, he also joined me in India. So later we were going to get married, but we were both similarly weird. So even though we were husband and wife, I think we're more like, and I think we were always just Kalyana Mittas, you know. Sorry. spiritual friends. So I've been asked about, you know, how it is that had a married couple ends up one a monk and the other a nun. But it just seems like the best possible way for both of us to live. I mean, it's the best life for him and it's the best life for me. So, you know, what more can you
I went to India when I was 19. And within about a year, I heard about meditation. And what really interested me was the idea of being alone with my own mind and seeing the mental patterns and how I create my suffering and my own happiness. So I heard about these retreats that were 10 days in silence. And I was just fascinated by that idea because until then, you know, I've been traveling a lot and experiencing so many things and yet I still wasn't happy. So I didn't know anything about Buddhism, but I went for the retreat and it just felt like coming home. It felt as though everything I'd always felt in my heart was now put clearly into words, and I was not abnormal for suffering. You know, in my teens I thought maybe there's something wrong with me. I've got everything, I've not been abused. You know, there's no kind of reason for that. But now suddenly here was the Buddha saying that actually life is suffering. But not only that, there's a way out of suffering. So for me there was a huge sense of relief. And I knew that I would continue that practice. So my first commitment was to meditation. And I stayed in Asia then for the next 7 or 8 years, doing a lot of meditation on the retreats and also serving on retreats, which was very interesting because sometimes on retreat you feel you get quite involved with your own progress and your own kind of practice, but serving others helped me to see that actually everybody experiences the same emotions, the same struggles, simply by being human, you know, and we all have the potential to develop compassion, to develop unconditional love and a sense of service. So, yeah, serving retreats was wonderful, and you'd see people coming looking sort of heavy and tired by life, and by the end they'd be just...
So there came a time when things were really falling apart for me, and I was guided to look for some meditation. I went here and there. In America, there's many different groups who teach meditation, different kinds of religious groups. And when I went, I saw that some of them were like superstitious. They were saying, if I only meet the guru, if the guru touches me on the head, that will save me. Other ones seemed to be looking for money. They had their hand out already asking for donations. I was of a skeptical nature and I didn't trust any of these so-called spiritual teachers. Then it so happened that one friend of mine said I should try this Vipassana meditation. She said there's no mumbo jumbo, They don't use any magic tricks. It's only watching the breath. And they sent me to a class that was being given by a Buddhist monk, a bhikkhu, there in Washington, D.C. This bhikkhu was so kind, so generous, so patient. He never was irritated by my questions. He didn't get angry if I went to class and fell asleep. Instead, he was just consistent and generous. And this bhikkhu, who was an American, at the end of the course, took us up to Bhante Gunaratana at the Buddhist Vihara of Washington and said if we want to pursue meditation, we should study with this monk there. So I met Bhante Gunaratana, called Bhante Ji. He's the one who wrote Mindfulness in Plain English. And again, I was profoundly moved by his deep spirit of happiness, the joy, and a straightforward quality. He never was pushing or trying to get more converts or get more students or get more money. He's just sharing what he knows and what sharing in a very free way. At first, the first time that I had a death in my family, I was so emotional, so distraught, so weeping and wailing, so grieved. But the monks told me to just stay mindful, be calm, and be relaxed. And when the painful feelings come up, just watch it. I found out by doing this meditation practice that the worst anguish, the most painful feeling, is very short, very temporary, and only lasts a few minutes. So then I knew if I had the courage to go for a few minutes, to bear the pain for a few minutes, then I know I'll be all right. That was my biggest turning point in what eventually brought me to come to the Dhamma. My father was gone, my mother was gone, my friend was gone, my house, my job, my thing, all gone. And then I entered into the Holy Land. Since that time, everything I do,
a PhD in microbiology at Murdoch University. And then I was also fortunate to get a job there as a postdoctoral research fellow at the same center, Center for Rhizobium Studies. And in 2005, I started my job. So when I started the job, then I thought, now the life is going to be like this. And I had this view of me sitting in the same table in front of the same computer with my hair all gone gray and still doing the same things, publishing research papers and giving talks and doing all these kinds of stuff. And I thought, now that time is running out, perception was a little bit more clear. So I thought, now is the time that I really should start meditating and pursue this beautiful path. So I remember in 2006, I invited Venerable Ajahn Brahmavasu and some of his monks for a house dhan at my place to celebrate my father's, 21st or 20th or so death anniversary. And that was 30th of October in 2006. And Ajahn Brahm gave a beautiful Dhamma talk and explained the amount of merit that I gained through giving this beautiful house dhana. But then he mentioned that how much more merit that is to actually even meditate for a few minutes. By this time, in the back of my mind, I already wanted to do a retreat, but it was so difficult to get into a retreat. But it was like a miracle. 3 days after this house dhana, I got a call from the retreat organizers, because I was already in the waiting list, and said the place has come up and I would like to do it. So I went to my bosses at work. They're so kind people. So I told them that I'm really going for this retreat. I didn't even ask them, can I take the time off? But I said that I'm going. That much I wanted to do so. They were so kind, and then I did my first meditation retreat. By this time I had no idea even how to meditate. But I knew this monk was really kind, that he wouldn't punish me or anything if I can't meditate. So I thought, maybe I'll have a holiday, just, you know, sleep, eat, meditate if I can, and see how it goes. So that's what I did. And in fact, Ajahn Brahm instructed in this way, so I was so happy. So after a couple of days, I realized that I could in fact meditate, and it wasn't so hard to do. So soon I became addicted to meditation, and then became a meditation junkie. But when I went on retreats, and when I stayed in monasteries, that felt like the right thing for me to do. So there came a time that staying in lay life felt like not the quite right thing to do, because I was happier when I was in a monastery. So I asked Ajahn Brahm what I should do, and he encouraged. Also, I was very fortunate to meet, during one of my work trips to San Francisco, Ayata Taloka. So she was a really wonderful Theravada bhikkhuni. And she too encouraged me, and she was really lovely. And she in fact invited me to join, come and spend some time at her Aranya. So then I had more confidence. So I sold my house, and I told my bosses that I would be resigning. And then I went to Aranya Bodhi, and there I shaved my head and became an anagarika, a homeless one. And I remember that whole week, I was walking around with so much joy. So much joy and so much happiness and so much peace. It was the best thing I ever did. And that whole range, the 3 months, my duty was to cook and look after the nuns who were spending the range there, because it was just a forest with no permanent buildings or anything. Everybody was staying in tents. We had a little caravan to cook our food. So it was quite a rough and rugged terrain. So the weather wasn't the best, my health wasn't in the best shape, but there was so much joy and peace, and I enjoyed it. So after my 3 months was done, I came back to Perth, and then I came to Dhammasari.
It all started in 2002 when I simply didn't know what to do with my life. I was so desperate to find an answer. I just felt there's something more to it than just running from one project to the other and exhausting oneself in distractions. And I simply felt something has to change, but I didn't know what to. And as it so happened, a friend of mine told me about Vipassana meditation. And I heard that before. He said, why don't you go and do a Vipassana course? And at that time, I just would grab any opportunity to help me in my despair. So the same night I looked it up, and I found a meditation course in the mountains of Switzerland, because I at the time lived in Germany. And without any hesitation, I signed up, and a few 4 weeks later I went there with the idea that I would sit on the Swiss mountain thinking about my life for 10 days and then hopefully after 10 days coming up with a solution and with an answer of what I'm going to do with my life. I went to the mountain, I went to the course, and for 10 days I was asked not to think at all, but basically to observe mind and body and whatever happens in the moment. And those 10 days literally transformed my life, because after those 10 days I came out of a different world. And then I decided to go to India and study Pali. And then after studying Pali, I thought, well, as I'm already in India, I have to visit the Buddhist sites. So I went to visit the Buddhist sites, and then I decided, well, the Dhamma is very well preserved in Myanmar. I think I have to go to Myanmar to the source. And so I came to Myanmar, this was in 2011. And as I come to Myanmar, as soon as I land on this golden land, I felt at home. And I felt like I'd been here before. And just from that moment on, one thing fell into place after the other. And it was probably about 4 weeks later, I found myself in a deep forest up north in Myanmar, sitting under a tree by myself in solitary retreat, 10 days of intensive meditation day and night. And those 10 days, I realized, this is what I want to do in my life, dedicate my life to the Dhamma, to the practice, and really see if I can develop a kind and a pure and a loving heart. within myself and for others. And the only way, or the only proper way for me to do it, was to do it as a nun.
Paul came not too long after the death of my husband, and my friend from Malaysia asked me to go with her to Burma for a long retreat. Fortunately, the friend who invited me to go never went at all. So I was there. The retreat was tough. It was painful because having to sit long hours in the hall without comfortable cushions. So still, I went through it, and it lasted for 4.5 months. When the teacher said that it's enough, and after that retreat, something in me changed, because when I came back from the retreat, I was no longer content with having short retreats, few days, or even twice or three times a day. So I wasn't content with that. I was looking for a place where I can meditate for a long time. My search for a place to have a long retreat ended at Dhammasara Nuns Monastery. So on the 9th of December 2009, three of us had our heads shaven, and we put on white robes. We had to take the 8 precepts formally. So, and also we have a new name. It's a Pali name, and so we don't use our old name anymore. So after that, we have to wait for another 15 months before we can go for the next ordination, which is to become a samaneri, that is a novice nun. So after 15 months, we... two of us, because one left after some time, she left the monastery, and two of us, Venerable Upeka and myself, we were ordained at Dhammaloka Buddhist Center on the 6th of March 2011. So both of us became seminaries on that day. And when we become seminaries, we put on brown robe, and we have to take the 10 precepts. That includes not handling money, and also we don't do certain jobs after that. So then, after that ordination, we have to wait for at least another 2 years before we can become seminaries, become bhikkhunis. In the meantime, more and more ladies are coming in to become nuns, and on the 27th of April, 2014, there were four of us who went forth to become bhikkhunis. I'm very happy to have chosen this path, because this is a really wonderful path. It's a path of harmlessness, of kindness,
and most of all, of a lot of letting go.
So the question is, how did I become a nun?
Yeah.
So I had this wish deep in my heart to become a nun. There came a time when the calling was so strong. I wanted it so much, but every single knowledgeable person I went to said, women can't do that. You can wear white, you can shave your head even, and you can cook and clean for months in the temple. You can never be a monk. I remember one period I cried at least an hour face down into the pillow every day because I would never be a monk, or so people were telling me. One day I was walking through my room and the thought November 1st came to my mind. I thought, what? November 1st what? Oh, I'm going to go forth. I'm leaving the home November 1st. That was it. It was as though announced to me. So I gave notice at my job. I gave notice in the home. I started to pack. While I was packing, I had a whole big stack of booklets I picked up at many meditation centers. Something told me, go through those booklets very carefully. So I'm like, okay, I'm going through the booklets. So something was tapping me on the shoulder saying, look. So I'm going through the booklets. And then I came to one that was an excerpt of a book by a monk named Bandigunaratana, and something seemed to say, look at it. I said, okay, what? Oh, hey, there's a photo of a monk, and there was an address. Again, remember, this is before the internet. When you wanted to know something, you wanted to know where to go and do this and that, you just click, you get the information. This was before that. I saw a monk's name and picture and an address. I said, oh, maybe that's a monastery. I'll put it in my address book. Then I left. I went, traveled around to some places in California asking questions. Where can a woman go? Where can a woman go? I went overseas. I came back to the States. Still searching. Where can a woman go? Where will a monk give a woman a chance? And I pulled out the little book. I said, well, that little booklet. I said, well, I'll write to these people. There wasn't even a phone number, I don't think. And they wrote back and sent me some information. I decided that I was planning to go to Australia because I heard that from a bit of a temple in Australia that I could go and stay there. So I booked a ticket to go to California, and from there I was going to later go to Australia. So I first decided I would visit this place that had the, you know, that monastery name, that address. So I took a train up to Washington, D.C., and then a friend in Washington, D.C. drove me out to this place. It was the Balada Society in West Virginia. Imagine my surprise. I discovered that the great Sri Lankan master who founded that meditation center and monastery out in the woods in West Virginia, a very, very backwoods place, not a cosmopolitan place, not a place where you would expect to find Buddhism in the United States. There he had this big, beautiful center, and here was a monk who was giving women a chance. And there I settled in. And there I was for the next 4 years. I received my seminary novice ordination there at Vaisakh in 1999. Later, I would leave there looking for places with more nuns. Many times I was the only nun. Some other times I was even the only woman there training alongside the monks. It was a big, spacious place. We had enough elbow room to do that, and the master was very compassionate to allow that. But still, I had some longing to be among some sisters. So I went off and started traveling some more. I ended up in Sri Lanka. There I received a higher ordination. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.